coming at you live from Austin, Texas. It's the Made for Podcast Movies podcast.
All right, welcome back. 2016, new year.
New year, new us.
New year, new podcast.
Ooh. All right. Tell,
so
why?
Okay. So yeah, we've how many episodes did we do? Do
you know? I think this is 8, or this one is 9, I believe.
This one's 9. All right. So
or
we'll
10,
just round up.
Whatever, yeah.
We should have had 10 because of the funny games one that went missing, the lost episode.
The lost episode.
So yeah, we thought 10 episodes. Me and Phil just started doing this as kind of for fun or whatever, and we've been really liking it. I think we've been getting a little bit better at it.
I think
know.
So too. It is one of the great joys in my life right now. I love it, man. I'm having a great time.
Right. And so we want to keep going. And, you know, I've been talking, me and Phil have been talking, me and Mike's Movie McClure have been talking, a frequent collaborator, and now staff writer, official writer for.
Yeah, he's on the bill.
But so we've been thinking, we're thinking about making it a little bit bigger. We're thinking about expanding the operation. We're thinking about keeping the length the same. We're going to still focus on one movie. But we're going to have different segments. So we're going to have other people writing in with different segments. And this will all make a lot more sense next episode when we announce it. There will be a lot more to come. We're looking at a made-for-movies podcast 2.0, so to speak.
Pretty much, yeah. And I mean, there might be some changes here, right? Like maybe some exclusions of something or inclusions of other things.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, like for instance, it'll be a different. We'll maybe talk about. Well, maybe we might actually also have this idea where we might be talking about two movies at once, and maybe coming up with a thesis or coming up with something that binds them
more
together.
More like thematic instead of just the movie itself.
Something about this podcast I realize is that a lot of it isn't so much about the technical. We don't ever break down technical aspects of the movie, partly because we're talking about something that's visual, largely visual.
Yeah, and then talking about it on a podcast.
That's all audio, right. It wouldn't really make sense. We're not. So I think with that being said, I realized, with that being said a lot, I'll put it that way. What I also realized was when we talk about movies, we most of the time just talk about the themes in them. It's really more of like a philosophy podcast.
Just musings and ramblings of like kind of our impressions of it.
Right. So I was thinking maybe if we hollowed it out and picked and stuck ourselves more to certain themes, and then we talk about the movies surrounding the themes, experiment with some different ideas like that. We don't know yet. We're going to kind of play it by ear. But the point is, it's going to be different going into the new year.
Yeah.
Correct?
And we don't even really know how different yet.
We
just know it's going to be different.
We've got people like Mike's Movie McClure. We've got my brother. We even have my mom. We have I got two other of my buddies that are going to write in. And we're going to try to develop something and run this like a well-oiled machine.
I got some friends lined up that don't know that they're lined up yet.
Cool.
So we're going
to
get them on.
So it'll be fun
board.
And it'll be consistent. And we're just going to try to get into, crack open into these movies even quicker. You okay?
Yeah.
All right.
Allergies are killing me, man. I'm going to try to not like sniffle into this mic. So like
man,
you told me to.
Let's put that a disclaimer out right now. Let's preface this episode by saying I am in the exact same pool. If you hear every once in a while, I'm clogged up like you will not believe. Allergies.
Hey, man. Worst city to live in with allergies in the country.
My ass, dude. Yeah. I should think Lexington, Kentucky.
Damn, I just did it.
Is number one on that list. So anyways, let's get right into it, though. We have a big episode today. The Fountain.
We do have a big episode.
Darren Aronofsky, The Fountain, 2006 film.
What a film.
Dude, I'm Jesus Christ. Where do you even start with this thing, though?
Well, first, let's talk about the director. You guys may know him, Darren Aronofsky, by such little films as... Go ahead, Dylan, bring us there.
He grew up in Brooklyn, went to Harvard Film School. Mm-hmm. From there, he went to American Film Institute, I believe, in New York or something.
His Wikipedia is right in front of me. So
Wrote a screenplay that got a lot of good, positive reception. People went crazy about it. Got $80,000 and made it. That ended up being this movie called Pi, P-I.
That was his senior thesis. Not Pi, but the thing he did before.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow. was in 1998. You should check that movie out. That was excellent. We'll talk a little bit about that because I think that movie was... the precursor to The Fountain, to be honest with you.
I'm so curious to see what you have to say about that.
Right, we'll talk about that in a sec. And then he did a movie that I'm sure a lot of you guys have heard of called Requiem for a Dream with Jared Leto. That one was blew up. I'm pretty sure that was the one that kind of put him on the map.
Yeah.
I mean, from what I understand, when we were in high school, that was like a big... Everyone in my high school, I remember, watched it.
No, totally. And that's we were just talking about that before the podcast. Man. Like, that was one of my very formative times of... like, I guess, filmmaking or film viewing or whatever you want to say. Like, Darren Aronofsky was such a big name.
Right.
And it was like, watch Pi first and then Requiem for a Dream. And then this little movie that came out after Requiem for a Dream.
Requiem for a Dream came out in 2000, 2 years after Pi. But then this one came out in 2006.
Yeah.
It was a full 6 years removed. You got to think that. I mean, that's a great segue to what kind of movie this is. This movie is epic, but also very restrained in the way that
very well put.
The themes are epic, and what's going on the screen is very hard to grasp. That I don't even think we watched it a bunch of times. I don't even think you and I have fully grasped it.
Yeah.
And we have plenty of people writing in or talking about it, two people that are trying to grasp it themselves, you know. And I don't think we could maybe point to a different reasons as to why that is.
Yeah. Let me interject really quick. To those of you who know Dylan, and I'm sure this is reaching out to your buddies mostly in San Francisco or something, but we've watched a lot of movies together, like a good handful of movies together. I've never seen such a reaction from you where you were like almost dumbfounded in some ways. Like we've watched movies together, and this is a testament to your movie viewing. Like you're very astute and, you know,
thank you,
observant viewer. And this time, like when it ended, you just had so many questions, and I was like, dude, let's save it for the podcast.
It was like 10 o'clock and Phil was trying to go home.
It's like, I gotta wake up for work. Yeah.
But I get, there is a little bit of that rebellion to me when I watch a movie like this, and when it's all said and done, I'm not able to connect all the pieces.
Yeah.
At least even if it's all subjective, right, at the end of the day, but if I can't form a theory about it myself, that bothers me. And I got to be honest, this is the first podcast where it's going to be a little bit out there. You know, like I don't have a full, it's mostly the third act that just fucks with me. I don't know. I can't put it together
fine,
the way
man.
It ends.
Yeah.
But let's put it this way. I'm going to try it. I do have a lot of interesting things to say about it, but it does frustrate me when I can't put something together. It's
no,
not
totally.
I can't view it as cohesive. And as acknowledging this ahead of time, I got two people, both Movies Mike is going to help us out, and my mom, who's become a hardcore listener over the past month or so.
Yes.
And she
shout
really,
out to mom. You're awesome.
Really liked this movie. Yeah. I went over last night to her apartment and we were talking about it. And she like filled me in. Well, she was, it's kind of nice having like, you know, like we were talking about her and I, a 50-year-old perspective.
Has she never seen it before?
She hadn't seen it, but she watched it and she really, really liked it. I think she has a little bit of a crush on Hugh Jackman. But
I do, man. That's shit. Or Rachel Wise, like, let's, ugh.
Yeah.
The Mummy, as we talked about.
Yeah, The Mummy.
Sorry, go on. Your mom.
She was raised with a little bit of religion in her life, so she was making a lot of connections to the Bible and whatnot.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, which I have no knowledge of any of that garbage. But I mean, as someone who does watch it, I mean, like, we didn't talk about those aspects at all, but so it was interesting to get that. And we're going to hear a little bit, we'll hear from her a little bit later. But, yeah, jumping right into it. Oh, and so, yeah, those two people, we're going to have Mike's movie with Claire and my mom. That'll kind of be like, you know, when you see singers before they sing, or instruments before people play their instruments, like they go, play me an A, or like, duh. It like kind of
warming up.
Calibrates that, or like gets them all centered. We're going to use those, I think, to keep us on track. Like other people's, because otherwise you and I could just talk, you know, a tornado of just whirlwind of bullshit. You know,
and our
like,
friends hate that.
Right. It's like, we're going to have we'll play some of those other clips to kind of like realign ourselves, so to speak, you know, if we get too far off base. But we're gonna do our best to try to keep this a little bit organized and pulled in. So you mentioned Pi.
Yes.
Right? And so I watched, when I first saw this movie, it's been a while since I had watched a Darren Aronofsky film, and so watched this first time, which by the way, this is my first time ever seeing it, and like you said, I was frustrated. I walked away being frustrated. I said, I need to find something to make this, you know, allow this to make sense. And so I decided to just go through all his work, you know.
Just
and
to
so,
kind of like see what, if there's any common like strands.
I wanted to get the ethos of, of his, I wanted to understand his voice and what he was trying to get at. Or even to see if I could discover something. And so,
I mean, he's made very different movies. Every movie is very different from one another.
Right. But I think there is a theme in a lot of them. So right off the bat though, Pi, I thought, was the most similar of all them to this movie.
Tell me why.
Okay,
you think
I think. Well, the only way I could tell you why I think that is by going into what I think the movie really was. You know, and again, which I told you I have a tough time doing. But let's put it like, let's just analyze the facts of the film. Regardless of all the crazy storylines, alternate storylines, go and whatnot. The movie was about a man who is in love with a woman who is dying. And why, instead of accepting and embracing those moments that he has left with her, he spent trying to solve the mystery of death so that he could spend more time with her.
Right.
And so, I mean, like, that at the heart of it, before we get really into the nitty gritty, like, that is at the heart of the narrative, right? It's a guy trying to understand, break nature, do the impossible to be with her longer. And, you know, and we'll talk about the sad parts of that or my opinion
That's
on that a little bit later.
I have a very different take on it.
Okay, fair enough. No, but I'll just, just to connect it to Pi, Pi was about, and again, if the, you know, go see Pi. You weren't, we didn't bring up Pi beforehand, so this might be confusing, but in Pi, really briefly, it's about this math, brilliant mathematician who's trying to solve the number 3.14, you know, the large pi, that and try to find out some sort of the secret to our existence through mathematics. You know, he's trying to figure out, and he's on this quest, and he's got some sort of weird
Like everything is math to him. Like right. everything well, can sees, be explained by numbers.
And so he right. thinks that if you were to hack this impossible number, that he'd be able to understand this massive law of our existence and pretty much solve, you know, everything. And, and it pretty much drives him crazy. No spoilers or anything, but it drives him crazy. And the idea, though, is there's all these great things around him that he's
neglecting.
Neglecting. And he's not really taking advantage of. And he reaches a similar fate that Hugh Jackman does at the end of The Fountain, where it's just this idea of you're so connected to your work. You know, you're so connected to this idea, these things that, you know, these ideas, you connect yourself so much that you forget to smell the roses, right, so to speak. And actually, if you think about it, if you look at Requiem for a Dream, they're all connected to drugs or some sort of X-Force stimulation, external stimulation, or such as like grandiose ideas of being famous in the mom's case, or heroin in the case of Jared Leto and
Jennifer Connelly.
Yeah, that's wrapped up. That's Marlon perpetuated Wayans? By their love.
Yeah, one of the white chicks.
but I mean, that's the same thing. They get lost to drugs. Black Swan, her quest for perfection, to be perfect, to become this Black Swan, negates.
What about the wrestler with his quest for redemption?
Yeah, the wrestler one's a little bit of an outlier. And again, actually, I haven't seen Noah.
Me neither.
Yeah. So, I think that there is a theme in a lot of these movies at the heart of it. But I think that The Fountain and Pi were most likely, I mean, most attached in that way. And I think also the endings, like I said, are very similar in that the way that they're sitting there and they're able to breathe and understand and finally, you know,
do
enjoy.
Do you want to hear my quick thesis?
Enjoy.
To kind of like add some perspective?
Sure.
Okay, so I'll be really quick. I've like really had to research this movie. Like I definitely like go to Reddit. I go to like film websites when we do these movies for these podcasts. And with The Fountain, it was definitely the most intense researching and whatnot. But what I kind of gathered is that I think we, in a literal sense, we get too hung up on the fact that it's Rachel Weisz's character that's dying. I think in the end, the coming to terms with death that is more important is Hugh Jackman's character. I think in the end, all three of those storylines, timelines, whatever you want to call them, are all connected by the fact that he is not ready for death. And whether that's him like channeling it through like the struggles he has with his wife, with the queen, with the tree, whatever later. That's like in the end, it's all about him not accepting death. It's him not knowing death. It's him being afraid of death.
That's exactly my point, though. It's like the idea is that he couldn't come to terms with the fact that she's going to die.
Right,
he
but didn't. I think it's about him too.
Right, totally.
I think it's all about him. There's also been a lot of theories I've read about where they're the same person, or that they're very much
Let's
like
not entertain
no,
that
but
shit.
No, and it's not like I agree with it, but it's very interesting perspective and in how they represent like two halves of the whole. Blah blah blah. Like there's a lot of shots that hint at this.
That's fine.
Yeah,
but I don't. I'm just saying. That's exactly my thought as well. I think it is all about him. Hugh Jackman is definitely the main character. Totally. It's about how he deals with death. That's my point. And the same way with Pi, it's about how he deals with the unknowable. Or what, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's the emphasis is on him for sure. I mean, he wants to eradicate death. He wants to change nature. He wants to, which is, and obviously in the movie he does it ultimately, but just the idea of that is so vain, right? And it's so selfish in a way, their relationship he has at this time, that rather than spending these moments with your dying wife or your dying...
Right.
You're going to, you know, whatever. These moments we have that are real. He's too busy trying to cure death or trying to cure disease, trying to cure cancer.
Or cure something.
She
goes,
you don't cure cancer overnight. You know what I mean? Like, this is go home and be with your wife. You ever the older woman says that?
Yeah.
But I think more importantly, if you want to zoom out a little bit, look on it on more of like a meta level, is the idea is he's trying to like the negativity that's coming in his life, he doesn't really want to acknowledge, you know? Mm-hmm. It's like he's not, he can't sit with the negative. Like, yes, they're going to die. We're all going to die, dude. You know what I mean? Like, guess with it. So really what he's trying to do is like take the bad out of life. And that makes me ask, like, what good is good without bad? if you have no bad, then there can't exist a good.
I don't necessarily blame him though. Like, but, like, put yourself in that position,
right?
I mean, I've had family members
who've died of cancer. I've seen them rot away, and it's you know, the thing is, it's a waste of time to sit there and curse cancer when it's nature taking its course. And sometimes maybe that's what makes these moments we have so special and beautiful. Is the fact that they're going to fucking end.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, this, what would, because if the life's not going to end, then you're going to sit there and go, oh, I'll do it later. And there'd be no rush to do anything because you could literally always do it later because life never fucking ends.
Yeah.
What is the importance, you know? So it makes me wonder, like, what is good? So I ask you this, what can you be in love if we all outlast for, if it lasts forever?
Yeah.
And obviously that's a tough question to drop on you right there.
Repeat that.
If life were to last forever, could you be in love?
I'm sure. I don't know forever, though.
Would it be the same thing, though? I mean, like, would it... I mean, I just... It's hard for me to view, assuming, you know, that you could be... Like, that something like love could have, could work if we're gonna... If we were able to stretch it out and spread it. It would lose the romance of it.
Well, I think that's totally represented in the timeline, which I guess... Or whatever, storyline. Sorry, we talked about this earlier. Of the storyline of... As I like to call him, and I've seen other people call him, the astronaut with the tree. You can see that. I mean, like, sure, the tree maybe is, it's literally just a tree that's, like, withering away. But, I mean, they're both alive forever, right? And you can see the damage it's taking on both of them, kind of. Like, sure, he's in this pristine, like, shaman, like, Buddhist, Zen-like quality to him. Whereas the tree is just withering away and dying. And it's like, that's, I guess, a representation of what would happen if something were to go on forever. Like... Sure, maybe one person benefits from it, but the other is not. Like, it's obviously not working in some respect. So absolutely. I guess that's kind of a half-assed answer to what you said.
Well, but, you know, I think it's best exemplified by the moment that keeps playing throughout the movie, which is which Rachel Wise is talking to him.
The first snow, come with me.
And he goes, no, I have to work. That's it right there. Your wife's dying.
That's probably the most important scene. Yeah,
and that plays multiple times throughout the movie because I think that's the moment that... Best exemplifies this conundrum. Your wife's dying. She's a limited amount of time. And rather than go and spending these amount of time with her and being with her, he's decided to go, no, I have to work. It's one of those things like now or later. And in a moment where if you have this train of thought that he has where it's like, I'll figure it out and then we'll be able to live forever. Later, like he chooses later by being like, no, we'll walk later. Choosing later works when we have infinity of time. The thing is we don't. Yeah. And the way that he was viewing it is like, dude, I'm going to crack this. I'm going to crack cancer. I'm going to solve death. He even says, like, you know, death is a disease. Like, we need to solve it.
And there's a cure. Yeah.
Yeah, but it's like, then you just pick later all the time, and that's the whole idea. That's where his mind is at. It's the later.
Very true.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, totally. He's not focused on the moment. Yeah, he's not worried about... He in his mind, he's already, like, solved it. And if he hasn't, then he has to work harder to it, and that, like, somehow will translate into her life extending on further.
What's interesting is I think about how much we as human beings choose the later, even knowing of our more mortality.
What do you mean?
Like, I don't know, knowing that you want to do something and putting it off either out of laziness or just thinking that you'll be able to do it later.
Okay.
You know, but like with that, it's kind of funny how it makes you, forces you to reflect a little bit on your own life of like how many times you've said later to, pardon me, a big opportunity, you know, or how, you know, and like the beauty of life. I think this is done really well where there's a turning point in the film where Rachel Wise's character, the one who's dying of cancer, kind of embraces it. Remember,
I don't think there's ever a moment where she wasn't embracing
it. But they suggest, though, that there was a turning point because when she starts to lose feelings and he starts to freak out, she grabs him and goes, no, listen, I'm okay with it now. Like, something happened.
He's
the
one that's not okay with it.
Especially when she had the stroke in the museum. She says, when he talks to her in the hospital, she goes, it's okay. Like, I felt I'm ready. That's what she said. And, and he was, you know, struggling to understand that. What do you mean you're ready? Like, how can you talk like that? Blah, blah, blah. Like, what he's doing is it's selfish. It's you're leaving me alone. I mean, like, you're dying.
Totally.
Like, you're leaving me. Like, how could you leave? And that's so selfish to say to, you know, I mean, like, rather than enjoy. So I think that haunts him. And so we can get back to this in a little bit because I have a scene that We agree we're not going to do favorite scenes, so because we just don't have. But I have one scene I really want to analyze that kind of best exemplifies this. But really quick, let's go to, before we break down the three storylines, let's hear what my mom had to say about it.
Let's go, moms.
Sounds good? All right, let's check this out.
Dylan and Phil, here's the devil's advocate with my opinion on the end of the fountain. The question, are there three Toms? My answer, no, there's just one Tom. And there's a book. And then there's the director's gift to us, this little analogy or metaphor for how Tom finally achieved enlightenment. The monk in the lotus position floating up to Shambhala or whatever the fuck name of that place is. That's him finally accepting death, being finished, and finding the awe that only death can bring. He achieves this by finishing the last chapter of the book when we see him stab the tree and drink from it. And instead of getting eternal life, he becomes one with the earth, the flowers grow from him, etc. So that's my take on it. Most likely I'm right. Peace out.
I think there's a lot of truth to that.
Yeah, I mean, that's so, actually one of the notes I wrote, like literally something I wanted to talk about, even if just for a brief moment. Why did he turn into flowers like when he got?
Well, let's put it this way. So we'll answer that. But while we answer that, why don't we talk about what let's talk about the three storylines and how we interpret.
Let's
that.
Go. Let's
okay,
do
so
it.
So I think the first one I've seen, you know, it really bothers me. I've read a lot of reviews just naturally after watching a movie like this. You got to see what the hell do people say.
Yeah, yeah.
What are our contemporary film critics saying? Oh, man, I'm struggling
with this.
We are just
sniffling hard.
And I noticed a lot of people called it like a time travel romance and stuff. Right? I don't see one fucking aspect about time travel in this movie. You know, like, I get it takes different storylines, but it's like, let's focus. Okay, first off, I think the conquistadors, the Spaniards that speak English, that whole part.
With British accents.
Yeah, with the queen. I think that was, I mean, I don't think, I'm fairly positive that was in the book. That took place in the book. Point evidence, every time it's only shown after he picks up the book. The editor made purposely put it so that all the words scroll by and then it goes into the story. And she says, I want you to finish the ending. We are left. The movie begins with everything towards up until the end, which hasn't been written yet. And so he goes over that ending multiple times because he hasn't had the balls to finish the book. Like she asked him as her dying wish was for him to finish the book.
Right.
And that makes sense if you look at the whole story arc of the conquistador storyline. It's her setting him up. It really plays out the same exact way it does in the current day storyline. Because it's like the idea is like remember she even says reference when they're laying in the bed in the current storyline and she leads in while she's at the hospital. He's like, we've almost found a cure. And she goes, my conquistador. Remember? It's the same way.
No,
the,
I totally get that.
Yeah, yeah. Right. It's the same way of like the queen being like, go to this place. Here's the dagger and find the tree of life.
Yeah.
It's the same exact thing. It should go and could take it to the current day. And she's saying, go and find this cure for my disease, you know? But the point is she left it out. She left the ending unfinished for him to come to his own conclusion. Yeah. So I think that's the storyline. I actually agree with my mom in that the only one that's actually going on that's real, or it, I don't like to use the term real, but because it's all real because we're watching it. But the only part that's really of importance that the other two crowd around is the modern day one.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the other one where he's floating in the bubble, so that we'll call that the third, you know, or like, you know, in order of chronologically, I guess.
Yeah.
The third one where he's floating in the bubble as the astronaut, so how you said it, is more of just a kind of like a way. See, this is hard for me to even explain because this is where we get broken up.
That's summed up, yeah.
I think that almost is representational or symbolic of his thought process, I think, almost. You know, of where he sit there, the way that he's haunted, but he's sitting by the tree, the metaphorical tree that she's brought into the book, and he's not man enough to finish the book, and he has to constantly replay these memories of her. You know, I think that's kind of, I would almost envision that as like his brain, so or his consciousness, of having to sit there, maybe...
Of his desire, almost, kind of like what he wanted to see out.
Well, no, just like what his like waking day of like just that's what it's like where he's sitting there thinking and those are the memories that pop up in his head. So I always feel like the only one that's like really consistent is the middle one, the regular like I feel like the other one's the story and the other one is just the thought process behind it. Kind of like the glue. I think that the one in the astronaut, that storyline, the third one as we agreed on, that is like the glue that kind of binds everything together. And
sure,
you know, so because it's not like you couldn't really accomplish the things that says narrative wise if it were all in the modern day one. So they need to kind of come up with that abstract way of him addressing it.
Well, so here's my thought process on this.
Yeah. So just
no, go.
No. Tell me like what? So now how would I everything I just said? How do you interpret it?
I honestly don't have a definitive response in the sense of whether I think this is like a time travel movie or whether it's three separate storylines or where it's all just one thing is happening and the other two are imaginary. I really like, I've gone back and forth on this and I don't have a definitive answer to it. However, whatever I think, I do know that they all are related somehow. And in the end, they're all just the same story being told in a different way and kind of like bringing out a different interpretation of like what is like what's happening, what's going to happen, blah, blah. It's hard for me to explain in terms of like spelling out the whole story to you. And to make it easier, I just kind of like broke down the three stories. And with this conquistador, I found he's seeking immortality for himself, right? Like in this one, he's seeking immortality for himself because it's like the desire of the queen. Now, if you think about it, the queen then is...
For both of them, not just him.
Right, okay, so, no, sure. But for him, the queen is still Rachel Weisz's character, right, obviously, forgoing all the fact that it's the same actress and whatnot. The whole, like, Inquisition, I believe is what it was during it, the kind of those cardinals, those priests, whatnot, that were kind of, like, taking over Spain.
I think they were the tumor in her
brain. I think they were cancer, right, exactly. So in him going on this journey, him going to just so happens to be in Central America, like, looking for the Tree of Life, or, like, it always struck me when the first time I saw this, I was like, why is going to find a biblical thing going to be the thing that frees them from their torment, you know, and whatnot. And basically, it's just the sickness of Spain, and she's needing a cure. And obviously, that's in the present day, the real one, as we've already kind of determined.
Right.
Like, that's obviously pretty on the nose. Like, hey, I have cancer, and you're going out looking for my cure. However, like, it's not going to change anything in the end, as we see with his resolution. And before we get too deep into the other things, like, with the present day, he has his love, his queen. Like, because in the conquistador era, he's obviously wanting the love of the queen, right? And he doesn't have it yet. In the present day, he has it, and he does what he can to offset death or create immortality. And then in the third one, we have that he has finally obtained immortality and the love, but his attachment is withheld from him seeking his ultimate peace. You know what I mean? Like, there's all these different approaches to the same problem of him trying to find his inner peace, him trying to find his resolution, him accepting death.
Right.
And I think that they all do this in it. Yeah, I'm repeating.
No, you're right. And also why and how it's so effective is I think we have to give a lot of credit to the editing.
Oh, man.
Because it's so well done because it doesn't lose a step. And it's going back and forth between these three drastically different plot lines, but three drastically different settings and worlds, so to speak, but the same plot line, if you think of it, like you just talked about, it's the same plot line over and over and over, but the editing makes it so seamless, so there's very few parts where you're confused.
Confused for different reasons,
but there's a lot of parts of just like I don't know, I'm hesitant to say confused, but we got the gist of a lot of that stuff. Can we talk about where before we get into where I think it went wrong, what did you think of the tattooing?
So, to me, I remember...
Or the ring.
The
ring and the tattoo,
and the tattoo. Okay, so to me, when we were watching this together a few days ago, I remember that became, like, the biggest point of conversation in it. Because, if I remember correctly, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, when he found out she was... I think she was dead, I guess. But basically, he had lost his ring, right? Which is another thing I'm going to bring up later. The ring is a very vital part to this whole story. As soon as he loses her, he starts picking at his finger, like your mom said, and creates that everlasting bond. Like, even though she's gone, they'll always be there. And then you kind of jump ahead to the astronaut, and you see that his whole arm is covered in tattoos. Now, whether that's a literal, like, he got on that tree rocket ship or whatever, and, like, for his whole existence has been tattooing... I don't think it's that obvious.
So, but before just to interrupt you right there, what you are referring to is I had this original theory that the third one, he's in the astronaut, it's actually because he does cure cancer at the end. He cures the disease. They let him know that to a certain extent. They include that in the movie for a weird reason.
But I don't agree. Go ahead.
No, that's right. But I'm just explaining what you were just describing was that originally when Phil and I were watching it, what I thought first was that after having solved cancer and pretty much mortality, that he's lived throughout centuries, and those were all markings on his arm waiting, and that tree he was in with that bubble with was the from the seed that he planted on top of her.
Right.
On top of her. I've since changed my theory, but that's what you're referring to.
Yeah. Right. And that's where we had like our biggest disagreement, I guess.
But you were talking about the tattoos, though.
Right. And that's probably like our biggest disagreement we've had of this podcast so far. Like,
well, I was just trying to feel a feeling. I was just set that out there to like, because I had nothing else to think about. I mean, I had nothing else to really go on, but so. Yeah, let's check out. My mom had some interesting stuff about the tattoo. Let's check that out.
Yeah, enlighten me, please.
There were a lot of parts I loved, but my most favorite was him tattooing the wedding ring into his finger. I don't know. I have this thing about watching skin get punctured. It freaks me out, but I watched, and the blood and the ink and the symbolism of this ring he couldn't keep because he just couldn't accept that there is no forever. To figure out that he could tattoo it there. Kind of like the memories and the love that will be tattooed into his soul. That was the only way he could get that ring. I love that part.
So, yeah. I mean, I think that kind of sums it up. I liked that idea, too. And I liked the what my mom was saying, there is no forever. That's a point that I want to stress repeatedly, I feel.
Yeah.
With this movie, is that because that's so important of like that the whole death is rebirth. That's a very out there concept. But I think what it means, man, I don't know. This is going to deviate now. But people get very hung up on, you know, this whole religion thing, or they like to think that there is an afterlife or that there is something. But since I was a little kid, I've always kind of had a problem with that. Of like, it dilute. What about the here and now, though? You know, like, why you were to live your life knowing that there's something after? Well, you know, how does that affect you living now? You know, because like I said, if it's forever, where's the rush? Or what's the purpose of it all? A double. We don't have a purpose. But so I think that something like love and all that is so special because it's this ephemeral feeling and it's something that you're in. It doesn't make sense. We don't really understand it.
Yeah.
Just like we don't this life either. So I think this movie works for the sole purpose, like kind of what Rachel Weisz's character comes to terms with, is that everything is temporary. And Hugh Jackman can't stomach that fact. You know, he refuses to accept that. I think that's really important for everything. I wanted to talk about, before I bring up my problems with it, my favorite part of this movie, though, was the bathtub scene.
Yeah. Oh, dude. Yeah, we both definitely agreed on that.
Yeah. Well, besides for it just being really pretty and beautiful, there was, I thought it was very symbolic, again, of what the point I'm trying to make here overall is. And it was like a really great love scene of love, like authentic love.
Chemistry between those two was amazing.
He's giving her a bath, and he realizes that she no longer feels temperatures, which signals a red flag, because obviously if you're not feeling temperatures, there's something fucked up.
Losing sensitivity. Right?
Yeah, that's not a good thing. And so it spooks. She's in her final stages of like a brain tumor, and it spooks Hugh Jackman. He gets very emotional. Oh, we got to call the doctor. I got to call the doctor. And she grabs him, and she's sitting in the bathtub. He's outside of the bath, fully clothed. She's butt naked, looking fine as hell, with that Natalie Portman shaved head. But grabs him, pulls him back, and she goes, no, like, I'm not afraid. It's okay. Like, I'm okay. And, he, you know, he bothers him to even say that, like, because he's obviously so afraid. And she pulls him close, and she goes, I think she says, I'm scared, doesn't she? Like, I'm scared, blah, blah, blah. Like,
I think that's where
I'm not
she
quite ready.
It, right?
I'm a little scared, but it's okay. You know, don't leave me. That's what she says. Mm-hmm. And so she pulls him close, and he's just all beat up. But then she grabs him and just starts kissing him. They don't even have time to have a conversation about it. She just starts kissing him. And Hugh Jackman's, you know, resistance towards the idea kind of starts to melt away. And he starts kissing her back. He's fully clothed, sitting on the top, on the side of the bathtub. And she pulls him in, like, fully clothed. And then there's that moment where he's like, obviously, like, when you fall into a pool with clothing, it's immediately uncomfortable because you're wearing these clothes that, I always go this way with these podcasts, but that society tells us we have to wear clothes. That's a thing that we've all just agreed on. When you sit and meditate on it, it's kind of absurd, right? That we all wear these like pieces of clothing that hang from our body to protect these one parts of our skin so other people can't see them. There's practical reasons for clothing. Don't get me wrong. Stay warm. I'm just saying, though, it's absurd. And when you're looking
also very telling of their dynamic.
Well, but when you're looking at death in the eye, don't you start to see all the absurdities of life, you know? And it's like, it gives you a full... And I love that idea that she pulls him in and they make out. or whatever, make out, whatever, in high school. They're kissing passionately and having this beautiful romantic moment, and he's fully clothed in this bathtub with this girl that's naked. And I thought that was so beautiful. Just just from a symbolic.
Very like they're lovers. They've been together for a long time. But their chemistry is there.
It's pure. It's like this pure, raw emotional attachment to one another that's boundless. It's beyond just like this material world, the materialism of clothing and like the bathtub. It's like it's beyond it.
You're going on a tangent, aren't you?
No, I'm just saying that was a really pretty moment, and I think that was what a lot of this movie was about. The power of, you know, and that how it's beyond any, it's timeless. That moment, that feeling is beautiful, mm-hmm. but it doesn't last forever.
It doesn't, no.
So I want to talk about it too. Before we get into the negatives, let's just finish one more thing. My mom had one more part that I really liked that she sent in, and it was about, let's go ahead and just take a listen. She could say it better.
One more thing. Awesome soundtrack. The only thing that was a bummer was I kept hearing in the back of my mind the Flaming Lips song, Do You Realize? So it was a little distracting with the soundtrack sometimes, but man, the message is kind of there, just the whole movie. Do you realize? That is
Do you realize that everyone you know someday will die?
Heartbreaking, and but instead also
of,
positive.
And instead of saying all your goodbyes, let them know you realize that life moves fast. It's hard to make the good things last. Realize the sun doesn't go down. It's just an illusion caused by the world spinning round.
Yeah, I'm sorry I interrupted you. I thought you were done.
But I'm just saying that well put, Mom. Like she's told me that. I was like, oh, that's a great point. That really sums up what I'm trying to say there. The finite nature, the ephemeral nature of life, you know? This shit doesn't last forever.
Let's talk about the fact that we do attain immortality, all right? The what if. And I think that's best exemplified in the storyline of the astronaut, or of when Hugh Jackman has gone full Buddha, or full Siddhartha, I guess, and is like traveling through space to Shibalba, I think, for Dylan's mom. I think that's how you say it. But I think what we fully realize there is what happens when we do obtain immortality. Like it seems pretty cool in some aspects, but at the same time, like that's a very tragic fucking like scenario he's in. Like he's just literally alone, trapped in this bubble, feeding off of something that like essentially wants to die or essentially needs to die. And I mean, what better way to exemplify that than by his wife who has cancer, and he's just literally and figuratively eating away at her, you know? It's like you said, it's his selfishness that is keeping her alive, when in the end, she's come to terms with it. The tree has come to terms with it. It's ready to go, and
He tells us the mirage or whatever, the memory of his wife, that he's ready to die. Remember, that's how it kicks the... So we could talk about the third act here. This is where some of my problems arise. So there's that moment where she dies in the regular, the present day plot.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. The present day plot, she dies, and we've stalled out the book portion with the conquistador. That part is stalled out because we've seen everything that has to offer. We end where it began, which she hasn't finished that ending. So we're done with that plot line, where she's died in the present day plot line. So now we're in the third one, where he's floating in the bubble, and that's kind of where the film, the third act, starts to come together, and it's him going back and forth to these mirages or whatever, until he eventually, memories, I guess I shouldn't call them mirages, they're the former mirages, until eventually he turns to her and goes, I'm ready to die. Mm-hmm. I think there's even that quote where she says, through death we will live forever.
Yeah.
And so finally he comes to terms with that. He goes, I'm ready to die. Like, and he's smiling while he says it. He's looking at her, and she's so happy or whatever. The part that I don't get, and I can't explain, is then it goes back to the present where she goes, hey, come out, it's the first snow. And he goes out with her.
Right.
How does that get rewritten all of a sudden?
But is that what's actually happening, though?
I don't know. You have to tell me. I have no idea what's happening.
I mean, I don't necessarily have a concrete answer, but I think I take from this, like, I may be in that camp the more I think about it in this podcast or the more we're talking about it. I think I may be in that camp where this actually is kind of a time travel movie and not specifically like he started here, he went there, and now he ended there. Like, I don't think that. I think, however, like, each of their stories in their own way is legitimate and happened, and I'm doing air quotes here, like, happened in its own way. So if we're following the rules of this movie, which I do when I watch this movie, and I just kind of, like, immerse myself and accept everything that's going on, I just think that, like, because it's possible it can happen, that it does happen. I think it is and is not happening. You know, if in any like classic kind of time travel or messing with time movie, I think that's like kind of like the what he wanted to happen. Like, see, the more he, because when he does, because I think that happens after he gets the eternal peace, right? When he's in space, I want to say it, regardless of not, I think it's just showing a moment in time where he could have achieved his peace there. Because in the reality timeline, I think it ends on a very sour note because it's him just like planting the seed, right, in her grave. And he says goodbye. Right.
Coming to terms with the fact she died. I thought that's the last shot of the movie. Right.
But I also feel like it's legitimate to say that in his own mind or in his own kind of resolution seeking, that him going out and following her on the first walk on the first snow was what he really wanted.
Let me go back to what you're saying. First off, most time travel movies follow pretty strict rules. I mean, that's why they're time travel.
Think about any time travel movie you could think of, the idea
is that they're fixed to a theory, which is time, and that you know, like, they have to comply with that. So I think just by that logic, it's not time travel necessarily. Like,
I'm trying to find another phrase, but...
But even so, that would be the only time in which he goes back to change something in the whole entire movie. But I mean, like, you don't just make an entire movie from like a... If you write a screenplay, you don't... Everything where it's going fine, then all of a sudden you're going to introduce this one element that's so extreme as going back and expect the audience just to be like, okay. Like, I just don't buy that. You know what I mean? Like, I think that there's something a little bit more, like, deeper than that going on. I think maybe... The only way I could see it is that it's like him doing it in his head like that, acknowledging that's what he should have done and doing it, you know? But then that would mean like what we see on the screen, it didn't really happen.
Sure. And it's but just th- more there's him a lot of things on screen that but didn't so, happen and did happen or, you know? Like, I accept the fact that there are holes in this. This is a very flawed genius work, I think. I do think... There are messy parts to it. I think there are times where I'm just scratching my head, even though I've seen this movie like 10 times now or whatever. And just a little backstory, like, we talked about this briefly, like, this movie was in development hell for a while, like, actors changed, production changed, blah,
supposed
blah,
to be Brad Pitt,
budget changed. Yeah, and I feel like, as much as I love this movie, there are flaws in it, and I think that's a result of the studio, whoever funded it, getting in the way and cutting a lot of this movie. Like, apparently there's a cut out there that explains so much more, or maybe has too much. I don't know. I like the movie that we've gotten, but I think there's also a factor of, like, what could have been, or, like, what could have been explained that we still will just never have to figure out, and we'll have to just kind of deal with it in the fact that take what you want from this movie, because, I mean... Every time I watch this movie, I think that Darren Aronofsky was like, there is no set answer for this movie. There's no set interpretation for this movie. I feel like the themes of death, of immortality, of selfishness, of, you know, responsibility, I think they're all valid and I think they're very core themes. But what you get from this movie in the end is up to you. And I think that's sure true of all movies, but I think this is a movie that really points that out.
But see, that's the thing though, is I just, there's that one part throws me for a loop and I
you're
can't
hanging on it, man.
Right, but I'm just saying, for most parts I agree with what you just said, but it's just so bizarre to introduce such a weird, like, again, we don't, that's the idea. It's the one part that deviates from the rest of the movie. The rest of the movie is built up this entire thing.
I don't agree,
thing.
Though.
But there's no other part of the movie that he changes anything. Right. That already happened in the past. So it does.
Well, for instance, if we're going on the argument that he's basically finished the book with the astronaut and she wrote the book with the conquistador, like the middle part has no set timeline, right? It has no set answers. It has no set actions.
She wrote the book, right? Well, let's go back.
I'm talking about the middle one, the reality one.
Right, so she wrote it, but he reads it. It's already up to that point. That's all established, right? And then the ending is when he fills it in, he is the astronaut.
Yeah.
Where he fills it in. So if you think about by that chronologically, that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm just saying, like, I don't have a problem with that. And even when he finishes it in a way that shows that he's learned is like that you have to die, and that he stabs the tree, like my mom said, and you know, he comes back to it. That all makes sense. But no one, not any other point in the movie does he go back and change something that happened.
Right.
That has already been established. That's all I'm saying. It's this
but
one part.
But did it happen is the question. Right, like,
we have to ask that. Like, what? Did it happen or not? I don't know. It played on screen. It sort of happened. But it's like, are we willing to pretend like it didn't happen or something? Like, what are you talking about?
Well, so
you know,
when
like,
I think of this
not
right
now. But like.
Right. No, the, when I think of this right now. So if I remember correctly, we see that scene where he's like, what are you doing here? She's like, it's the first snow. It's repeated a couple times.
Right.
I think three.
And he goes, no, I'm working. And she goes, all right, fine. Runs away. She's angry.
So, I mean, there's times where, like, it's the astronaut in his place. There's times where it's him in reality. There's time.
But it's always the same. It always plays out the same. He doesn't go with her.
Not necessarily, though, because in one of them, it's the beginning scene, right? And it's him. They end on the fact of him just being like, I have too much work, blah, 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 and she leaves. The second time we come back to it, he goes to work on Donovan, the chimp.
Well, that's because they don't show
surgery.
The full thing all
right.
the way through.
But then the third one, which is him following her, I think it's just, again, like, this
it's like
movie
the
works.
The fifth one.
Well, whatever,
yeah,
sure.
Yeah.
But
I'm saying,
again,
like, they've
this,
firmly
this,
established
this,
it as
this movie
one.
Also shows a lot of repeated scenes like that, though. I don't think it's too
right,
hard.
But my point is not one of them has changed besides for that one.
But I don't agree. I think there's subtle changes. I think there's, like, it's, again, him not doing anything, him going to surgery, and him following her. Like, those are the three major
but
ones.
But give me one other example of when they changed something.
I don't think
happened.
There's another example. I
right,
think,
that's what I'm
but
saying.
But like we said, that is the most important scene to us because there are variations in it, because
right.
it sets the tone
well, no, but
for
there
their
aren't. There's only one variation in it. And that's the one that they show at the end where he decides
no,
to go with
No, that's
her.
Not true.
What's the other one?
Because there's one where he goes off to do surgery, where he completely ignores
they all,
her.
They all go off to do
no,
surgery.
No, he doesn't. In the first one, it ends before they even, like,
but
she
that's,
leaves.
But, no, but the only thing is they just don't show what happens after because they do the same exact sequence again and they show what happens
right,
beyond that.
Right, but that's different. If that's the argument you're using, it's a change. It's
no,
different.
But narrative-wise, though, the idea is that he goes one way and the other one, he goes the other one way. The first time they show it, they just don't play it all the way through. They just keep focusing on that point where he turns
right,
her
for
down.
For a reason, I think. For a reason, because it's showing the variations in it, and it's showing that time
but
isn't linear in that
but
aspect.
I don't know about. I would disagree with that because the first time they show it, it just stops right before where she
right.
goes. So stop, and they do
and
it again, and it stops.
Surgery. Yeah.
And no, then they do it a third time, and then he goes to surgery with his hair. Remember, and so they play it two times before, but the same exact thing happens. They don't change anything. They just add on it. Nothing's being changed. You know what I'm saying?
I don't see it that way. Though.
No, but so they do the exact same thing the third time, even. Except it just keeps going this time. Nothing's changed. You know what I'm saying? And then he goes to surgery. And then they do it again, and he does the same exact thing and then goes to surgery. So literally nothing's being changed. It's just adding more. But then the fifth time they do it, he doesn't go to surgery. He goes right and actually changes.
I don't understand why
you
have such
difference?
A big problem with this, though.
Because I just explained. Because it's the only point in the movie in which they do that.
And so what? Like, why can't there be a deviation from the timeline? Why can't there be a change in it? Because obviously we've shown that time, like, the rules of time in this, like, movie are not very linear. Like, they're not solid. There's wiggle room because, I mean, for instance, she wrote the whole conquistador thing. That was all up to her. The whole, like, astronaut story, that was up to him, if that's what we're arguing. So in the middle, I feel like there's some leeway in what direction things go.
See, actually, I think everything is linear, though. Like, even though it's displayed out of order, but if you look at all the plot lines, if you were to, like, straighten them all out,
uh-huh.
everything is linear. There are no changes.
Well, sure, in that aspect, yes. However,
yeah. The only change is the part
formation
I'm bringing
decisions
up.
Made were not linear. Like, they could have been anything, you know what
right,
I mean?
Right, but I'm just saying, if you were to, let's put it this way, Phil, you just brought up a good point. If you were to put them all out linearly, so there was no editing to put them all out, they would all play out in order.
Right.
All of them would be out
but
in order, and there'd be
yeah.
no, like, there's no change. But then, so, then there's one point, though. They go back at the end of the movie and take the linear order and go right to the beginning and just change it so it goes a completely different way.
Right.
It's like that. I just think as a plot device, that's – and let's put it this way. Neither one of us have an answer for what the hell it means. I think that – like it just throws a monkey wrench in the whole thing for me.
To me, I had no qualms with it solely because I thought it was a beautiful resolution. It was a very, like, what could have been moment. It was a very – powerful moment in the sense of he finally put aside his bullshit and put aside his selfishness and decided just to follow his wife out for one more time. And that's what I got from it.
Right. I like that. But you could do that with any movie then. I mean, the idea is like, how do you get us there?
Yeah. That's this movie clearly depicts that it's not following any sort of rules.
But we disagreed that it is all linear. It did follow a lot of rules. It's just that
linear in the sense of the storytelling, sure. However,
no, but I mean, like, there are no loopholes, really. I mean, everything makes a lot of sense up to that point. I mean, it's definitely a convoluted movie, but it makes sense.
Ruin the movie for you? Like,
no, well, I wouldn't say it ruined it. I still enjoyed it, obviously, overall, but I just think that part of the movie just seemed out of place. That's all. It just seemed, it didn't make sense to me.
Huh.
And that's okay. Where it kind of jumbled up the ending for me, where it was just like, you didn't show us how we got here, so it's not as impactful for me.
But I guess that's just how you interpret it, because we interpreted this movie because
you could take any movie where it's like, yes, he learned his lesson, and I think it's a beautiful lesson, I think it's a beautiful message and whatnot, and again, I like the movie, but I just think that part could have been so much more impactful if there was a little bit more of it. And obviously there is point to it. I don't think he just threw in something like that out of random. There is something that it has to represent that I'm just not picking up on, but I don't think it's any sort of like time travel or any, you know, Back to the Future type shit.
Not talking about time travel in a traditional sense.
I know. But a lot of the reviews had it as like a time travel epic or some shit. It's like, I think that's selling it short. You know,
let's agree that this movie is very misunderstood and very misinterpreted.
Obviously. I mean, I have a tough time interpreting it. I mean, I can't. My only qualms with it were that last part.
Yeah.
Well, just the way they tied it all up together. It just seemed a little rushed and lazy. That may have been because of, you know, the budget constraints or something, or like them having to cut it down to a shorter time period. And so I get it. But I've seen a lot more ambiguous movies that make a hell of a lot more sense, like Tree of Life or something more crazy. That even Requiem for a Dream is fucking nuts all over the place. And it's still, there's nothing, I'm left with that movie being like, okay, I get the gist of it. It's just that one part that just didn't, I just don't know how he went back and he did that, even though they showed us opposite. That's all I'm saying. All
right.
So, yeah, I think we've made that abundantly clear, that one moment. Great. Yeah. But overall, great. Like my mom said, great score. And obviously,
that score, like, I love it. It's almost up there with me, my favorite of his movies, like with Requiem for a Dream.
For a Dream is obviously probably the most well-known one. If you don't know what we're talking about, just look it up. You'll have definitely heard it 1,000 times. Even The Wrestler had like that Bruce Springsteen song on it there. That was great.
Fuck yeah, dude.
You know, Black Swan had all that old traditional music, and even Pi had that cool drum and bass shit.
Nineties, electronic.
Yeah, a lot of his movies have really cool scores. Yeah, yeah. This one's no exception. Like I said, the editing's great. Very trippy. Probably a good movie to watch stoned, I'd imagine.
Shh. we're not promoting that.
I don't know. Overall, pretty solid movie. Dude, definitely out there.
I love it. I fucking love this movie.
Right on. All right. Well, then, you have anything else to say?
I'd also just love to say, like I said, this was a huge movie for me in my teen years. The soundtrack is one of the first that I downloaded as a kid and like listened to on repeat.
That's so bizarre.
Downloaded, yes. Clint Mansell, it will always forever live in my memory as one of my favorite composers. This was one of those movies that when I first watched it, again, I just had no idea what to think. And I think, honestly, that's a mark of a great film, whether you think it is a great film or not. I think it's just, there's something special about it. I think the cinematography, we haven't even talked about that. Like, I feel like this whole episode is going to be so jumbled in a lot of ways, but I think that's, like, because of the movie's, execution. Like, there's so much to talk about and there's so much to interpret that anyone who does an episode or, an analysis on this is going to have wildly different things to talk about.
Let me ask you this. So this movie came out in 2006. You were 15.
10 years ago, 14, 15. Yeah.
So you went to Best Buy and bought the soundtrack to this orchestral soundtrack?
Absolutely not. I fucking went to, what was it? LimeWire or whatever. Okay.
I'm joking. Just shit.
No, but I did. I got this movie in Wrecking for a Dream for Blockbuster when it was still around.
Damn.
So that's a throwback right there.
Blockbuster.
I mean, the cinematography is amazing. I love the practical effects in this movie. All the space things, if I remember correctly, it's none of it is actually CGI. It's all kind of, I think it's them zooming in on microscopes or they use dye to an extent, kind of with the Tree of Life, how they did the cosmos scenes and that.
Whoa.
Amazing, dude. Yeah.
Trippy.
I don't know. I think whatever you think of this movie, I think it's a special movie. I think it's one that is very vastly underlooked, I should say, underrated. Yeah, I mean, you can just tell by our conversation that there's a lot to talk about in this.
Yeah, well, we still got to hear from one more person, and that's Mike's movie McClure. I think knowing him, we haven't listened to this yet, but he probably... let's just put it this way. I'm curious to see what he has to say. Let's go ahead and check it out.
Our unofficial third member.
New staff writer, Michael's movie
McClure. New staff writer. Well, you're going to be hearing a lot more from him, guys. Get ready.
Our intern. Our unpaid staff writer. All right, let's check it out.
I know what you're thinking. And yes, I, Mike, Movies McClure, a.k.a. the cinematic sensation, will tell you the answer to the question, what exactly that movie was about. And there is a correct answer. But first... I'm going to go over three fun facts that were not on IMDb trivia for I don't know why. Number one, this is actually Wolverine's origin story. Number two, Rachel Weisz, who's a method actress, of course, showed up on set having written her own copy of The Fountain with authentic 12th century quill and ink, but knew none of her lines. Fun fact number three, all of the tears Hugh Jackman cried in the film were preserved and sent to the AFI Museum in Hollywood, where they now fill a small koi pond by the entrance. All right, before I tell you the answer to the question what this movie was about, I should note that I have a very serious girlfriend who I spend, upwards of four nights a week hanging out with. So it definitely gave me a unique perspective on this flick. And I'm not telling you, Dylan and Phil, because I know you already know the depths of our love. I'm more talking to your listeners who probably don't know because they don't watch the news. But Colleen and I, when we walk down the street, God plucks a harp whose strings are made up entirely of single unicorn pubes. That happens every time we hang out. So bear that in mind that I view this movie and every movie through a specific lens. But this is still the objective answer. And the answer to this movie is... The key to immortality is to accept certain death and cherish your transient life. I'll let that sink in. I'll continue. Hugh Jackman's character should have spent his wife's final days with her instead of trying to save her. His wife was already keenly aware of like the fact that I mentioned above, that he couldn't save her or himself. But she couldn't tell him because he just wouldn't take it clearly because he was such an angry dude. So she had to show him by the way she lived her final days, the way she carried herself. And hope he just realized this fact on his own. But she did give him one more clue, and that was writing The Fountain. But still, she only wrote up to the point where the conquistador, representing her husband, Hugh Jackman, aka the future Wolverine, took on certain death incarnate in the form of some wise Mongolian dude with a fucking fiery sword. Then only he could write the ending. When he literally rises above death instead of fighting, he conquers it and is given access to the Tree of Life. But it didn't make him an immortal human, the cum that comes out of the Tree of Life. It didn't make him an immortal human like he thought it would, but a mortal flower, which too will die, but not before creating seeds like the one Hugh's character holds during the last shot of the movie above his wife's grave. That's right. Another day on the job, another movie solved. Someone get me a beer.
Right on, dude.
Oh, we're
hell
having
yeah.
a beer for you right now, Mike.
Dude, that was so okay. It was funny. I liked it was funny all the bit, but he actually nailed it at the end. I think almost better than we did the entire.
Yeah,
thing.
we took like an hour.
Yeah, but no, pretty much this, he summed up what we said pretty quickly. In fact, especially that one line he said it. But dude, thank you, Mike's movie McClure.
Mike, we look forward to hearing more from you, man. We want you back on here.
There you
week.
Go. all right, so that'll do it. We're not going to do my favorite scenes this time just because that movie was a clusterfuck and a half. And I don't know if we could even really make sense from a production standpoint.
Right.
Like we said at the top of the show, this will be going forward. We're going to have a big new design. We're going to go to the drawing board. We're actually going to start running this bitch like a business, you know what I'm saying? And we're going to get like other people to come in here. We're going to run it like a magazine, so to speak.
We want guest spots. We want clips. We want... Quotes.
Yeah, we want,
we people, want everything.
Let's
yeah.
get aggressive about this stuff. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. I don't want to have to keep hitting up my mom and my brother and my best friend to be doing this shit. but no. I've got interest from a couple of friends who are going to be doing some cool shit. And so there'll be recurring segments and whatnot. It'll be funny. It'll be serious. We're going to hold on. We're going to maintain the thing. It's not going to be like an all-out movie podcast. We're going to still keep the maintain. That'll be We're going to maintain the cohesive theme of one movie or two movies. And so with that being said, I want to announce for next weekend will be Valentine's Day, or the weekend when this comes out. She'll be...
think so. It'll be around Valentine's Day. Anyway, our theme is going to be...
February 12th.
Around love.
Love. And I thought, rather than pick one film, I was thinking we could pick two.
This was approved by me, so don't worry, guys.
Yes, I've read this by Phil. And the two that I'm going to pick are Woody Allen's classic Best Picture winner, Annie Hall.
Mwah.
A beautiful, beautiful movie. Hilarious. Probably created the contemporary romantic comedy. If you haven't seen this movie, it's great. Women, guys, of all... Everyone will
it's
love it.
It's a pretty perfect movie.
It really is a pretty perfect movie. Yeah. And I'm going to contrast that with Blue Valentine,
ooh,
which, well, how do you pronounce the director's name?
Derek Cianfrance, whatever his name is.
There you go.
Is that the one I'm talking about, right?
I think
he
so,
did,
yeah.
He did Place Beyond the Pines,
right,
too?
Yeah.
Right,
so yeah. So this one has Ryan Gosling and Michelle Williams. It's... I know what you've already seen this movie. You're probably scoffing right now and how it's super depressing.
Or crying.
But we're
going to
talk about how it's actually not so depressing. The theme will be love. And we're going to talk about how these two movies represent love. And we're going to compare and contrast them. And I think this is going to be a new format for us. It'll be really interesting. So if you want to watch both of them, I know Annie Hall's on Netflix and Blue Valentine is somewhere. But Blue Valentine is excellent. Both these movies are excellent. Both these movies are actually probably in my top 20 favorite movies of all time. So think about that. I mean, like, and so we're going to be comparing them. We're going to get input from Movies Mike. We'll probably get some original content from him. We'll get the motherly perspective from my mom. We'll get some cynical takes on it. We'll get some funny stuff. We'll get some insightful things. It's going to be awesome. It's going to be a facelift, and it's going to be Made for Movies Podcast, the podcast 2.0. You can't miss it. And so for anyone who's listening to this, you guys got to get in touch with us. Let us know what you're thinking. Tweet, email. Phil, what do they got to do to talk to us?
You got to tweet us. You got to message us on Facebook. Got to hit us on the website.
What's
on
the website
Gmail.
Again?
It's all made for podcastmoviesguys.com. Made for podcastmovies.com. I say this all the time. We own that domain. My friend Patty, like, he worked really hard on that website. Go check it out. It's good shit.
Shout out to Patty.
Find us on iTunes. We've got a good amount of episodes, man. Like, every time I look at that list, I'm pretty proud of ourselves.
Right
on. We started this as like a pipe dream with just talking about Spring Breakers.
Totally. and the thing is, we're building on it, so it's getting better. But yeah, you got to hit us up with any questions. And if you want to, literally anything, like if you write anything, you write fucking three words, we'll say it on the show.
We'd
Don't
love
worry
to
about.
Hear it.
And so, get that being said, we're going to have a lot of new segments, a lot of things going forward. You're entering a new era. Welcome to 2016. And thank you for listening again.
Yeah, and we're going to be taken away by some sounds by Clint Mansell from The Fountain. So
Jesus
enjoy
Christ.
That.
Filling his heart on.